and I'd never tell anyone it was you. I'd just be so happy to be home. That's all I'd care about. I wouldn't tell the police. I wouldn't...
And then crash. The back of Noelle's hand hard and sharp across Ellie's cheek. Enough, she said, her voice still and hard. Enough. There'll be no going home until I say. You need to stop with your talk of going home. Do you understand? Ellie held the back of her hand to her cheek, rolled the cool flesh across the red sting of Noelle's knuckles. She nodded. Good girl. Noelle went out that night, and Ellie awoke in the dark, confused by the sound of heavy footsteps down the basement stairs.
Ah! Did I wake you?
Noelle was in the room. She swayed slightly in the doorway, before clicking it shut behind her and locking it. Ellie sat up straight, clutched her racing heart. Noelle looked strange. She was wearing an awful lot of makeup, some of which had been rubbed away. One eye had more eyeshadow than the other. There was a black smudge by her cheekbone. And she was dressed very smartly. A shiny black blouse with fitted black trousers and some high-heeled shoes. She had a single gold hoop in one earlobe. I'm sorry, she said, edging toward Ellie. I didn't realize how late it was. I've had a bit to drink, and you know how the time just rolls itself up when you've had a few jars. Ellie shook her head. No, said Noelle, perching herself on the side of Ellie's bed. Of course you don't. You're just a girl. She smiled, and Ellie could see a blackish stain on her teeth.
So,
she said, aren't you going to ask me where I've been? Ellie shrugged. I've been to my boyfriend's flat, she said.
Did I tell you I have a boyfriend?
No.
I bet you can't believe it, can you?
Boring old Noelle, the tutor, having a boyfriend. I mean, he's not a patch on your fella. Obviously not. But he's a god to me. Cleverest human being I've ever met. No idea what he sees in me, of course.
You look very nice tonight, said Ellie,
obsequious in the wake of Noelle's slap to her cheek earlier on. Noelle glanced at her.
Oh, you little sweetie.
I do not. But thank you. Ellie smiled tightly.
Anyway,
how has your evening been? Ellie shrugged and said,
Okay.
Noelle glanced around the room then and sighed. I was thinking maybe I could fix you up with a TV and a DVD player. You can get one of those little all-in-one things for next to nothing these days. It might mean less treats and what have you for a while, but better than staring at these four walls for hours on end.
What do you think?
Ellie blinked. A DVD player. Movies. Documentaries.
Yes, please. Thank you, yes.
And some books.
Would you like some books to read? Yes, I would. I'd love some books.
Noelle smiled fondly at her. Books, then, she said. I'll pick some up from the Red Cross shop. And some DVDs. We'll make it nice in here for you. We'll make it as good as home. She got to her feet then, and looked down at Ellie and said,
It's all coming together now. I can feel it. It's all coming together. Just you wait.
Ellie watched her fiddle clumsily with the key in the lock. She sensed a moment of vulnerability. She played with the idea of ambushing her, throwing herself upon her, slamming her drunken, makeup-smeared face into the wall once, twice, three times, grabbing the key from her, shoving it hard into the lock, turning, opening, running, running, running. But even as the thought showed itself to her, the door clicked open, and Noelle Donnelly was passing through it, and then slamming it shut behind her. And then she was gone.
Mummy,
Ellie whispered into the palms of her hands.
Mummy.
Ellie would never really know what happened the following night. She could guess, because of what happened afterward, but the actual facts, the details, only one person knew, and she would never tell her. Noelle came down with her supper at 6 o'clock. It was chicken nuggets and chips, with a perfunctory spoonful of mixed peas and sweet corn on the side. There was a big cream bun on the tray, a small bowl of jelly beans, and a glass of Coke with a slice of lemon in it. Noelle cooked for her as though she was 5 years old. Ellie ached for a bit of sushi, or some garlic prawns and rice from the posh Chinese up the road. Noelle stayed a while that evening. She'd brought Ellie a new book and some fancy shampoo. She seemed to be in a sparkling mood. "How's the dinner?" she asked.
"It's nice, thank you."
"You're so lucky," she said. "At your age, you can eat and eat and eat and never gain an ounce."
"But you're very slim."
"Well, yes, but that is purely because I barely eat. When I turned 40, oh," she made a circle of her mouth. "What a shock that was. No more cream buns for me. And the older you get, the worse it gets. I'll be living on water and air by the time I'm 50 at this rate."
"How old are you?"
"Too old," she said. "Far too old. I'm 45. What a silly sounding age that is, to be sure."
"It's not that old."
"Well, love you for saying that, but all the same, it is that old. Particularly when it comes to certain things." Ellie nodded. She didn't know what the certain things were, and she certainly wasn't going to ask. "So, it's a joy to have a young person to cook for. I can buy all the yummy things in the shops, instead of just looking at them." She smiled, and there were the tiny teeth that chilled Ellie's soul. And that was that. The edges of Noelle Donnelly began to blur and shiver. The walls of the room turned black and bled into everything, and for a small second, there were just Noelle's teeth, suspended alone in a sea of blackness, like a UFO in the night sky. And after that, it was the morning. And even though everything felt normal, Ellie knew it wasn't normal. That something had happened. Chapter 41. Then. The summer slowly died away and nothing changed. The nights became longer. The temperature dropped 5 degrees. Noelle bought Ellie a fleece-lined hoodie and some warm pajamas. The foliage around the basement window was still green. It was, Ellie imagined, September. Maybe early October. Noelle wouldn't tell her. "Oh, sweet girl. You do not need to know. It's of no use to you to know. No use at all." And then one morning, lying on her bed, Ellie felt something very strange. A small judder, like a pop, going through her middle section, as though a person living under her mattress had just nudged her in the back. For a terrible moment, Ellie thought she was lying on a hamster and quickly jumped to her feet to check. But no, there was nothing there. She sat gingerly on the edge of the bed, waiting to see if the sensation returned. But it didn't, so she lay back down on the bed. As she lay down, it happened again. This time, she could place it. It was coming from within her, bubbles popping inside her stomach. She rubbed and rubbed at her stomach, trying to ease the bubbles away. Eventually, the pops dissipated, and the inside of her own body stopped doing surprising things. By the evening of that same day, Ellie had forgotten entirely about the otherworldly feeling, the sense of being occupied, the sense of no longer being alone. Chapter 42. You may recall the exact night of conception. It was the night after I came to yours all dressed to the nines in my satin blouse and my high heels. The night we drank 2 bottles of champagne and had sex 3 times. I thought it would be a long-term project. I had more plastic pots waiting in the freezer. Let's put it that way. But it turned out I didn't need them. I'd been charting Ellie's ovulation for a couple of months, making sure to dole out the pads and tampons on a day-by-day basis so I'd know exactly when she was bleeding and how much. And I hit the jackpot the first time. I stood by with the tampons and the towels, waiting for Ellie to ask me for them. But 2 weeks passed, 3 weeks, then 4. And then she started to be sick every morning. And I knew. I waited until Ellie was about 4 or 5 months along before I told you about the baby. I put it off for as long as possible, so the period of subterfuge would be as short as possible. Because, of course, if it was to be your baby, then you needed to think I was pregnant. And in order for you to think I was pregnant, I needed to look pregnant. And if I was going to fake a pregnancy, then that was the end of our sex life. So I told you the doctor had said the placenta was low-lying, and so there was to be no sex. So there was no sex. But as you probably recall, we did plenty of other things, because, of course, I had to keep you. More than ever then, I had to keep you. I said I'd been to the scan alone. Really hammed it up, do you remember? I couldn't take it if the baby was gone again. I couldn't bear to let you down again. You were sweet about it, but I could tell your heart wasn't in it. I could tell that without the sex, without the intimacy of sharing a bed with me, of passing your hands around my body, of the shared bottles of wine and the lions on a Saturday morning, that I really wasn't a good fit for your life. The baby was neither here nor there to you. I could tell. I felt in a way that you were hoping I'd take the baby as a consolation prize and disappear somewhere with it, like a low-ranking lion taking a scrap of old skin from a kill and slinking away with her tail between her legs. We'd never been close, not in the way that other people see as close. And the little that had held us together all those years was starting to crumble, like mortar between bricks. I could feel us coming loose from each other, and I didn't have a clue what to do about it. The only hope I had was that when the baby came, you'd fall in love with it, that you wouldn't be able to live without it, and that we'd be inextricably linked. Forever. Chapter 43. Then. Her stomach was stretched as taut as a space hopper, laced with bluish veins and dissected by a long brown line. She could sometimes see the vivid outline of a small foot pressing at the paper-thin skin, elbows and knees. Once, she even saw the delicate pencil shading of an ear. The person inside her rolled and roiled and danced and kicked. The person inside her pressed hard against her lungs and her esophagus. Then the person turned over and pressed hard against her bladder and her bowels. Noelle bought her pregnancy books to read and medicine to counteract the indigestion and the constipation and the backache. She bought her a special pillow, shaped like a banana, to keep her knees apart at night. Ellie liked the pillow. It felt like a person. Sometimes she spooned herself against it, laid her cheek upon it. Noelle bought a book of baby names, and she'd sit and read them out to her. She bought a doctor's stethoscope, and together they listened to the baby's heartbeat. Noelle would run her hands around the bump and talk about what she could feel. "Ah, yes, that baby's on the move," she'd say. "It's turning beautifully. It'll be engaged before we know it." Ellie had suspected she was not fat but pregnant a few weeks after she'd first felt the baby moving. She couldn't pinpoint the precise moment. It just became increasingly obvious, day by day. She'd stared at Noelle one afternoon, trying to think of a way to ask the question while simultaneously not wanting to know the answer. Eventually she'd said,
"Something's moving inside my stomach. I'm scared."
Noel had put down her cup of tea and smiled at her.
"You have nothing to be scared of, sweet thing. No, no, no. You just have a little baby in there. That is all."
Ellie gazed down at her belly and stroked it absent-mindedly.
"That's what I thought," she said.
"But how could it be?"
"It's a miracle. That's what it is, Ellie.
And now you know.
Now you know why I chose you.
Because I couldn't have a baby of my own, and I asked God to find me a baby, and God told me that it was you.
That you were special.
That you were to have my baby."
Noel looked rapturous, elated, her hands clasped together in front of her heart.
"And look," she said. "Look at you now. An immaculate conception. A baby sent from the Holy Father. A miracle." "But you don't believe in God."
Noel moved fast, and Ellie was too big to move swiftly enough to get out of her way. Whack. Noel's hand hard across the back of her head. Then Noel was gone from the room, turning the locks hard behind her. Noel refused to countenance any questions about the provenance of the baby inside Ellie over the following weeks. All Noel did was smile and talk about our miracle, and swan into Ellie's room clutching tiny sleep suits from Asda and little knitted slippers from the Red Cross shop, a wickerwork sleep basket with a tiny white mattress and a gingham shade, a little book made of cotton that squeaked and crinkled and jingled when you touched the pages. She brought lovely cream for Ellie's swollen feet and sung lullabies to the bump. And then one day, in the very early spring, Ellie awoke in a strange mood. She had slept badly, been unable to find a position in which the baby wasn't squashing some part of her insides. And in the moments that she had slept, she dreamed vividly and shockingly. In her dreams, she gave birth to a puppy, hairless and tiny. The puppy had quickly grown into an adult dog, a hound from hell with bared teeth and red eyes. The dog had hated her. It had skulked outside the door to her room, growling and slavering, waiting for Noel to unlock the door, so that it could come in and attack her. She awoke from this dream 3 times, sweating and hyperventilating. But each time she fell back into sleep, the dog would be there, outside her door. She was keen to see Noel that morning. The night had felt long, virtually endless. She wanted a human being to break the strange spell she'd cast herself under. But Noel didn't come at breakfast time, and she didn't come at lunchtime. With every passing minute, Ellie became more and more anxious, more and more scared. When she finally heard the sound of Noel's key in the lock, in the early evening, she was ready to throw herself at her and sling her arms around her neck. But when the door opened and she saw Noel's expression, Ellie immediately recoiled into the soft cocoon of her bed.
"Here,"
said Noel, slamming a bowl of Cocoa Pops, a bag of Wotsits, and half a packet of Oreos on the bedside table.
"I haven't had time to cook."
Ellie sat cross-legged, her arms wrapped around her bump, looking at Noel in surprise and fear.
"Oh, stop with the big brown eyes. I'm not in the mood for it. Just eat your food."
"It's not very nutritious,"
she ventured quietly. Noel had been making a big effort to give Ellie vegetables and fruit since she'd become pregnant.
"Oh, for fuck's sake," she muttered. "One shit meal's not going to kill you or the baby."
She sat heavily on the chair, radiating fury. Ellie waited a few minutes before speaking again.
"Where have you been?"
she asked, pulling apart the packet of Wotsits.
"That's none of your affair."
"I was worried," she ventured. "I mean, it made me think, what would happen if something happened to you while you were gone? Like, Maybe you were in an accident or you got ill. What would happen to me?
Nothing's going to happen to me. Don't be stupid.
No, but it might. You might get a concussion and forget your address. And I'd be locked here with a baby in my tummy and no one would know we were here and we'd both die.
Look, said Noelle, exasperated. I am not going to get a concussion. And if anything else happened, I'd tell someone you were here. Okay?
Ellie saw that Noelle was losing patience, that she should drop the conversation right now and eat in silence. But what she'd just said, that she would tell someone she was here. This was new and transcendental and extraordinary and thrilling. This couldn't be ignored.
Would you really?
She asked, slightly breathless.
Of course I would. You think I'd just leave you here to die?
But what about?
She picked her next words carefully.
Wouldn't you be worried? That the police would come? That you'd be arrested or something?
Oh, for crying out loud, child, will you stop?
Stop with all this nonsense.
I've had enough filthy shit today already to last me a fucking lifetime. I do not need any more from you.
All I do is spoil you and care for you, and all you do is sit on your huge, fat arse thinking up stupid things to worry about. I have put my life on hold for you and that baby. Now just stop whining and let me deal with everything. For God's sake.
Ellie nodded and stared into the orange rubble of the crisp packet, her eyes filling with tears.
Those animals stink, by the way, Noelle growled, tossing her head in the direction of the hamster cages. Get them cleaned out, or they're going down the toilet.
And then she was gone, and Ellie was alone. Outside the high window, a sharp wind threw the tangles of the leafless foliage around like tossed hair, while Ellie ate her Wotsits and prayed for a bus to bang into Noelle Donnelly next time she went to the shops, prayed for her to be hospitalized for long enough to have to tell someone about the girl in her basement with a miracle baby growing in her tummy. Noelle didn't seem to be excited about the baby anymore. The bigger Ellie got, the more disinterested Noelle became. The gifts stopped, the baby name stopped. There were no more little sleep suits to admire or gentle palpitations of the bump to see what position the baby was in. Noelle still came 3 times a day to visit Ellie, to bring her food. No longer the healthy, good-for-the-baby meals of the early months. No more boil-in-the-bag vegetables and uninspired arrangements of tomato and cucumber. Just fried food in varying shades of white, pale brown, and occasionally orange. And often, she stayed to talk. Sometimes these chats were mundane. Sometimes they bore precious nuggets of information. The weather outside, for example, with its suggestion of the changing seasons. Or the increase in her business, as children in the world outside began their GCSE studies, with its suggestion of the time of year. Other times these chats were a kind of catharsis for Noelle, an unburdening of herself. Ellie had found these mood swings terrifying at first, had never been quite prepared for whichever version of Noelle might come through her door that day. But as the time passed, she started to get an instinct for Noelle's psychology, started to sense immediately what their chat would be like before Noelle had opened the door, just by the rhythm of the fall of her feet on the wooden staircase outside, the sound of the key in the lock, the speed with which it opened, the angle of her hair across her face, the sound of her breath as she drew it in to form her words of greeting. Today she knew immediately that Noelle was in a self-pitying mood. Flop, 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 came her size 8.5 feet down the stairs. Sigh, before she put the key in the lock. Creak, as the door opened slowly. And sigh, again, as she closed the door behind her. Here, she said, presenting Ellie with her lunch. 2 slices of white toast, cowering under the contents of a can of Heinz beans with mini sausages, a film-wrapped pancake filled with chocolate spread and rolled into a flattened tube, a can of Lucozade, and a bowl of jelly beans. Ellie sat straight and took the tray from Noelle. "Thank you." She began to eat in silence, aware of Noelle brewing and cogitating beside her. Finally, she heard Noelle take a deep breath and mutter, "I'm wondering, Ellie, what the heck this is all about. Aren't you?" Ellie peered at her, and then moved her gaze back to her beans on toast. She knew better than to offer any input when Noelle was like this. Her role was simply to be a human sounding board. "Everything we do, every day, the effort it takes just to get out of your feckin' bed every morning. Doing the same goddamn things every day. Switch on the kettle." She mimed switching on a kettle. "Brush your teeth." She mimed this, too. "Choose your clothes. Comb your hair. Cook your food. Clear up your food. Take out the rubbish. Buy more food. Answer the phone. Wash your clothes. Dry your clothes. Fold your clothes. Push your clothes away. Smile at all the cock-sucking bastards out there. Every day, over and over and over, and there's no opt-out. I mean, you can see why some people take to the street, can't you? I see them sometimes. The homeless. Lying there on their cardboard mattress. Dirty old blanket. Can of something strong, and I envy them. I do. No responsibility to anyone. For anything. And you know, I must have been mad thinking I could do this." She gestured around the bedroom, at Ellie and her bump and the hamsters in their cages. "More mouths to feed. More drudgery to add to the workload. More money to find to pay for more things that will need to be washed and cooked and folded and put away. I don't know what I was thinking. I really don't." She sighed deeply, and then got to her feet. She was about to leave, but then she turned and glanced at Ellie curiously. "Are you okay?" The question was an afterthought. Noelle didn't really want an answer. She didn't want to hear that Ellie had barely slept in days because she was too uncomfortable at night. She didn't want to know about Ellie's sore tooth, or the fact that she'd run out of clean underwear and was washing her pants by hand in the basin. Or that she needed a new bra, as her breasts were now the size of watermelons. Or that she missed her mum so much, her insides burned with it, and that she could smell summer approaching, and could feel the days growing longer, and that she cried when she thought about the smell of fresh grass and barbecues in the back garden, and Jake on the trampoline, and Teddy Bear the cat stretched out in the pools of light that fell upon the wooden floorboards. She didn't want to know that Ellie no longer knew what Ellie was, let alone how she was. That she had bled into herself, become a puddle, a pool, plasmatic in form. That sometimes she felt as though she loved Noelle. Sometimes she wanted Noelle to hold her in her arms and rock her slowly like a baby. And other times she wanted to slit Noelle's throat, and stand and watch as the blood spouted out, slowly, magnificently, running through Noelle's fingers, the collapse of her, then the death of her. Ellie knew what Stockholm Syndrome was. They'd studied it at school. She'd read about the Patty Hearst case. She knew what could happen to people kept in captivity for prolonged periods of time. She knew that her feelings were normal. But she also knew that she must not let those feelings of affection, those moments when she yearned for Noelle's attention or for her approval, she mustn't allow them to dominate. She needed to hold on to the parts of her that wanted Noelle dead. Those were the strong, healthy parts of her. Those were the parts that would one day get her out of here. Chapter 44. Ellie was 8 months pregnant when you ended it. Or, In other words, I was 8 months pregnant. I just feel for the sake of the baby, we should draw a line in the sand now.
You fucking bastard.
He said that the relationship had run its course and that you wanted to play a part in the baby's life, but that you thought it was for the best if we went our separate ways as a couple. That we should work out how to be apart before the baby came.
How to be apart?
Ha! What does that even mean, Floyd? I don't think you really knew, to be honest. I think you were just sick of not getting any sex. I think you wanted to be able to go off and screw someone else. That's what I think. I managed not to beg. I managed not to plead. And I still had my trump card. The baby. I was very calm. Remember? I went up to your room to pack up the belongings that had migrated there over the years. My toothbrush, my deodorant, my hairbrush, spare pants. That kind of thing. I dropped them all into a carrier bag. They made a sad sight when I peered in at them. I was wearing a top of yours. An oversized t-shirt that skimmed my fake bump. I thought about stealing it, but then I thought it would have more poignancy if I left it draped across your bed, for you to come upon that evening as you climbed into bed, for you to maybe think, oh, Noelle, what have I done? When I left the room, your horrible daughter was standing there on the landing, looking at me as she did with those horror movie eyes. Fuck you, I thought as I swanned past her. Fuck you. Because I knew what I had in my basement. And I knew that it was better than her. And if it was better than her, then it could still bring us back together. I had not lost hope. Chapter 45. Well, I wouldn't say it was a textbook birth. No, I wouldn't. I'd read everything there was to read on the subject of home birth, and there was no eventuality I wasn't prepared for. Apart from the really, really awful ones that would have taken us to a hospital, I suppose. I had my story all lined up. A desperate niece, too ashamed to tell her family back in Ireland. Well, you can guess the rest. But it didn't come to that. I got that baby out of her without any medical intervention. I'm not saying it was pleasant. It was far from pleasant. But out that baby came, alive and breathing. And that was all that mattered at the end of the day. She was a sweet baby. Full head of brown hair. Little red mouth. I let the girl choose a name for her. It was the least I could do after what she'd been through. Poppy, she said. I'd have preferred something a bit more classical. Helen, maybe. Or Louise. But there you go. You can't have everything your own way. I left the baby with the girl those first few days. Well, there was not much I could be doing now, really, was there? And then when the baby was 2 weeks old, I took her to the baby clinic to get her weighed and checked, get her on the system so that she would be a real person and not just a tiny ghost in my basement. I had to answer lots of awkward questions, but I had my spiel sorted. Didn't know I was pregnant, thought it was my menopause, hardly changed shape, gave birth at home with my partner. All happened really fast. No time to call for an ambulance. Wham, bam, there was the baby. So no, we never went to the hospital. No, the baby was not given an Apgar score. I told them that I'd been too nervous to bring the baby out of the house before now, that I thought it was okay as long as the baby seemed okay. I sat and took their telling off, let them slap my wrists good and proper. Oh, I said, I'm really, really sorry. But you know, I was a virgin until a few months ago. I used my strongest Irish accent for this. I've led a sheltered life. I don't really know much about anything. They sighed and looked appalled, and made notes about me, no doubt. Potential loony. Keep an eye on this one. but they gave me all the papers I needed to register the baby at the town hall, and made me an appointment to come in 5 weeks later for my postnatal exam. I didn't go, of course, but had I done, I think they'd have been very impressed with the pristine condition of my underneath, and told me a midwife would be coming to interview me later that week. I just pretended I was out when she came, and hid in the back room while she rattled my letterbox. She came again a few days later, and she called me about 100 times. But she gave up in the end. I duly took the baby to all the appointments at the clinic. She got her shots, she was weighed and measured. I did the bare minimum to keep them off the scent. But, in social worker parlance, we slipped through the net. Worrying, really, when you think about it. But the girl, meanwhile, well, I thought I'd done my best by her. I really did. But she didn't seem well. It was one thing after another, really. First, an infection down below. That seemed to heal of its own accord. But then she got an infection in one of her breasts. Or at least, that was my theory. I read up about it on the internet. I told her she must feed the baby from that one breast. Feed and feed and feed. She was very hot. Then very cold. I gave her over-the-counter remedies, but they didn't work. She lost interest in the baby, and I had to take over feeding her. Then she stopped eating. She called for her mother all the time. Incessant it was. All hours of the day and night. I couldn't bear it for another moment. Then one day, when the baby was about 5 months old, I shut the door to that room, and for a very long time, I did not go back. Chapter 46. Joshua had given Laurel his grandparents' phone number in Dublin, Henry and Breda Donnelly. They were both alive, and both still working. "They're amazing," Joshua had said. "Like, really amazing. Scary as shit. You don't want to cross them. But incredible people. Forces of nature. The pair of them." Laurel calls them on Sunday, when she gets back from Floyd's house. A woman picks up the phone and says, "Hello?" So loudly that Laurel jumps.
"Hello? Is that Mrs. Donnelly?"
"Speaking."
"Breda Donnelly?"
"Yes, this is she."
"Sorry to bother you on a Sunday. You're not eating, are you?"
"No. No, we're not. But thank you for asking. What can I do for you?"
"I've just met up with your grandson, Joshua."
"Ah, yes. Young Josh. How is he these days?"
"He's great. Really great. I went to visit him at your daughter's house. Noelle's house." There's a brief silence on the line, and then Breda Donnelly says,
"Who is this, please?"
"You haven't said."
"Sorry. Yes, my name's Laurel Mack. My daughter used to be one of Noelle's students. About 10 years ago. And as a weird coincidence, my current boyfriend is Noelle's ex-partner. Floyd Dunn. The father of Poppy." There's another silence, and Laurel holds her breath. Eventually, Breda says,
"Yes?"
Pulling out the vowel to suggest that she needs much more information before she'll offer any herself. Laurel sighs. "Look," she says, "I don't really know why I'm calling. Except that my daughter disappeared shortly after she finished her tutoring with Noelle. And she disappeared right next to Noelle's house. And then Noelle herself also disappeared a few years later."
"And?"
"I suppose I just wanted to ask you about Noelle. About what you think happened to her." Breda Donnelly sighs.
"Are you sure you're not from the papers?"
"Honestly, I swear. You can Google me if you like. Laurel Mack. Or Google my daughter. Ellie Mack. It's all there. I promise.
She was supposed to be coming home.
Laurel blinks. What?
Noelle. That week. She was coming home. With her little girl.
Oh, she says. I didn't realize. Floyd just said that she disappeared. He didn't mention that she was supposed to be going back to Ireland.
Well, maybe she didn't tell him that. But she was. And the papers barely cared. The police barely cared. A middle-aged woman. A bit of a loner. An ex-partner. Who said she was mentally unstable. I told them she was coming home, but they didn't think it was relevant. And maybe it wasn't.
And she said she was coming home with her daughter.
Yes. She was coming home with her daughter. With Poppy. And that they would be staying here. At the house. And we were all ready for her. We were. Beds all made up. We bought the child a big bear. Yogurts and juices. Then suddenly, she's given the child to the father, packed a bag and disappeared. I suppose we weren't surprised. It always did strike us as faintly unbelievable that she'd had a baby in the first place, let alone that she was able to raise it on her own.
So you think she changed her mind? That she was going to start a new life, with you and Poppy, and then freaked out at the last minute?
Well, yes. It certainly seemed that way.
And where do you think she is, Mrs. Donnelly? If you don't mind me asking.
Oh, God. I suppose, if I'm honest, I would say she's dead.
Laurel pauses to absorb the impact of Breeder's words. When did you last see Noelle, Mrs. Donnelly?
1984.
Laurel falls silent again.
She came home for a few weeks after her PhD. Then she went to London. That was the last time we saw her. Her brothers tried to visit when they came to London, but she always kept them at arm's length. Always made excuses. We had no Christmas cards from her. No birthday cards. We sent news on to her. New nephews and nieces. Degrees and what have you. But there was never a reply. She genuinely, genuinely didn't care about us. Not about any of us. And in the end, I'd say we stopped caring about her, too.
Chapter 47. I first brought the baby to see you when she was about 6 months old. I dressed her up in the most spectacular outfit. A cardigan with a fur collar, of all the things. It was in the sales at Monsoon. And a tutu. And shoes. For a baby. Quite ridiculous. But this baby was the prettiest thing you've ever seen, and I wanted her to really dazzle the life out of you. The day I brought her to meet you, I had the butterflies. I called you to warn you that I was coming. I wanted us to be made welcome, for a friendly cup of tea to be poured for me, for you to be ready. It was a sunny morning, a hopeful day, I felt. You answered the door in a horrible jumper. I'm sorry, but it really was. You never were the snappiest dresser. We had that much in common, but really this was off the scale. A Christmas present from your horrible daughter, no doubt. You didn't look at me. Your eyes went straight to the baby, in the car seat that I was holding. I watched your face. I saw you absorb her. This fat-limbed, tawny-skinned, dark-haired plum of a child. So different from that scrawny, miserable thing your wife had made you. You smiled. And then, God bless that bonny child, she smiled right back at you. She kicked her little satin-shod feet. She gurgled at you. It was almost as though she knew. As though she knew that everything hinged on this one moment. You ushered us in. I put the car seat down on the floor in your lovely kitchen and looked around, enveloped immediately by the sanctity and niceness of being back in your personal space. And strangely, I felt more like I belonged there in that moment than I ever had when I was your girlfriend. You made me the cup of tea that I dreamed of you making for me. You passed it to me, and then you crouched down by the car seat, looking up at me, and said, "May I?" I said, "Please, go ahead. She's your daughter, after all." You unclipped her straps and she kicked those little feet of hers and held her arms aloft for you. You plucked her out softly but securely, and you brought her to your shoulder. I think maybe you thought she was younger than she was, because you hadn't seen her when she was a newborn. But she showed you that she was a bigger girl than that, and turned herself around in your arms, held her hand against your cheek, tugged at the straggles of beard on your face. You made faces at her. She laughed. "Wow," you said. "She's lovely, isn't she?" "Well, I'm a bit biased, of course." "And she's 6 months, yes?" "Yes. 6 months on Tuesday." "Poppy. It's a pretty name."
"Isn't it?"
I said.
"And it suits her, I think."
"Yes," you agreed. "It really does." You blew a raspberry at her then, and she looked at you in utter delight. "And how's it been?" you asked. "How's it been for you?"
"It's been..."
I plastered a stupid smile on my face and didn't mention the endless, nightmarish nights, and I'd been in her room 2, 3, 4 times with endless bottles of milk. I didn't mention how sometimes I'd put her in her cot for an hour and sit in my kitchen with the radio turned right up so I couldn't hear her crying. And I certainly didn't mention the time I seriously toyed with the idea of leaving her on the steps of the hospital, just like your own parents had done to you. "It's been amazing," I gushed. "She's a real dream. She sleeps all night, and she smiles, and she eats. And honestly, Floyd, I can't think why I didn't do this a long time ago. I really can't." You really liked this response. I could tell. Probably in your head, you'd had me painted as a terrible, sexless, aging crone that you were best shot of. And suddenly here I was in your kitchen, looking well. I'd been to the hairdressers and made them take my hair back to its original copper. It was the first time I'd been to a hairdresser for anything other than a trim in about 20 years. And with this drop-dead, gorgeous baby that I was clearly in love with, like any normal woman would be. And I could feel you then. I really could. Reevaluating me. Reconfiguring your prejudices. I could feel that we still had a chance. I stayed for an hour and a half, and when I left, at my behest, off to a fictional friend's for supper, you came out of the house with me, holding the baby in her chair. You insisted on strapping the chair into the back seat. I watched you adjust the straps on the seat, making sure they weren't too tight around her fat little arms. "Bye-bye, gorgeous Poppy," you said, kissing your fingertips and placing them against her cheek. "I hope I see you again. Really, really soon." I smiled inscrutably and then drove away, leaving you there on the pavement, not knowing where you stood with anything. And that was exactly where I wanted you.
Chapter 48. Bonnie calls Laurel at work on Monday. Laurel recognizes her been-around-the-block voice immediately.
"We've been talking," she begins. "About Christmas?"
Laurel stops herself groaning. She cannot possibly bring herself to think about Christmas, even though it's less than a week away, and the world is full of lights and music, and even the plumbing supplies shop has baubles in its window. She's not ready for it.
Now, unfortunately, we're at my stepmother's on Christmas Day itself. She's 84, far too frail to make it down to London, so we'll be heading up to Oxford. So what I thought is that we could do a big Christmas Eve bash here. We can do gifts and games and cocktails and what have you. And I have space for thousands, so all the children, partners, etc. And you can absolutely bring your gorgeous man and his lovely daughter.
She pauses for breath. Laurel can hear the rattle of a cough in the base of her breathing.
What do you think?
Laurel fingers the pendant at her collarbone.
Have you asked Jake?
She asks, after another pause.
Yes. Yes, I have.
There's a finality to this that tells Laurel immediately that Paul and Bonnie are now aware of the current impasse.
And is he coming?
He says he thinks so.
And what about Hannah?
She said yes. She'll be coming.
Laurel's stomach lurches. Hannah has completely transmogrified, in her mind, from an ice princess destined never to thaw, to a scarlet woman, throwing herself at other people's boyfriends with no thought for anyone but herself. Laurel no longer knows what to think about her daughter.
Well, she says after a significant pause, that does sound lovely. I'll ask Floyd. He did say that he and Poppy usually stay in on Christmas Eve, but I'm sure they could be persuaded. Can I get back to you?
Yes, of course. Please do. But sooner rather than later, if you don't mind. I'll have to get my Waitrose order in by tomorrow at the very latest.
Waitrose orders. Laurel cannot imagine that she ever had a life that involved Waitrose orders. She puts down her phone and sighs. At Floyd's that night, Laurel asks him how Poppy had reacted when Noelle dropped her on his doorstep and disappeared into thin air.
Was she happy?
She says.
Was she sad?
Did she miss her mum?
What was it like?
Well, first off, he replies, she looked awful. She was overweight, refused to let anyone brush her hair, bathe her, brush her teeth. So she was a mess. And that was basically why Noelle left her with me. She'd had this perfect little baby, and she'd totally fucked her up, because she did not know how to parent, and she'd ended up 4 years later with a monster. And no, Poppy wasn't sad. Poppy loved being here with me. When she was with me, she behaved. She didn't have tantrums. She didn't demand chocolate spread on everything. She sat, and we talked, and she learned, and she read, and when Noelle left her here, she was happy. Really happy. And of course,
he shrugs.
Neither of us had any idea that we would never see her again after she dumped her with me. We thought she'd be back. And by the time it was clear that she wasn't coming back, Poppy and I were a team. I genuinely don't think she's suffering because of not having Noelle in her life. I think...
He glances up at her.
I think it was a blessing.
Laurel's eyes flick to Floyd's and then away again. A thought passes through her head. So fast, and so unpalatable, that she is unable to keep hold of it. Poppy stands at the top of the stairs. She hangs off the banister, her head tilting at an angle, her hair swinging back and forth.
Laurel,
she says in a stage whisper.
Quick, come up.
Laurel looks at her quizzically, and then says, Okay.
Come in here quickly.
Poppy pulls her by the hand into her bedroom. Laurel has never been into Poppy's bedroom before. It's a small, square room overlooking the garden. She has a four-poster bed with white muslin curtains, and the walls are painted white. Her duvet cover is white, and her curtains are white, with a fine, grey stripe. There's a chrome lamp on her white bedside table, and white bookshelves are filled with novels.
"Wow," says Laurel, stepping in. "Your room is very minimal."
"Yes," she replies. "I like keeping it all simple. Sit," she says, pulling out a white wooden desk chair. "Look, my Christmas present for Dad arrived. Tell me what you think."
She opens the door of a white wardrobe and pulls out an Amazon delivery box. Then she pulls out a large mug with the words, "Unbearable Coffee Snob," written on it.
"Oh," says Laurel. "That's fabulous. He'll love it." "Because he is, isn't he? He's ridiculous about coffee. You know, that stuff he has to have, otherwise he says he'd rather drink water. Grown in Ethiopia with water from angels' tears."
Laurel smiles and says yes. Lots of people are a bit weird about coffee these days, and she really can't tell the difference. And she's the same with wine. It all tastes the same to her, unless it's bad. And as she's talking, her eyes pass across the detail of Poppy's room. And she stops and clasps her chest. "Poppy," she says, getting to her feet, taking a few steps across the room. "Where did you get those candlesticks?" Poppy glances up at the top shelf of her bookshelves, where a pair of chunky, geometric silver candlesticks are displayed.
"I don't know," she says. "They've always been there."
Laurel reaches to pick one up. It's hugely heavy in her hand, as she'd known it would be. Because they are her candlesticks. The candlesticks taken in the burglary 4 years after Ellie disappeared. The candlesticks she's always been certain Ellie took.
"I don't really like them," says Poppy. "I think they were Mum's. You can have them if you like."
"No," says Laurel, putting it back on the shelf, her stomach churning over and over. "No, they're yours. You keep them." Chapter 49. Then. Ellie lay on the bed. The moon shone down on her, waxy blue. The foliage outside rustled in a sharp breeze, crackling and popping like distant fireworks. She tried to swing her legs off the bed, but they were too weak. She couldn't remember the last time she'd eaten. 6 days ago? Maybe 7? She was partway to delirium, but still aware on some subliminal, terrifying level, that she had been abandoned. She could hear her baby crying upstairs from time to time, and an ache would emanate from her heart to every point on her body. But she had no voice to call with, and no will to live. Her head was pulsing, aching, sending her strange pictures, flashes of imagery, like scenery lit up at night by strikes of lightning. She saw her mother, stirring a tea bag in a mug. She saw her father, zipping up his jacket. She saw Theo, throwing a ball for his little white dog. She saw Noelle, turning over her homework, sliding her glasses up her nose. She saw a house they'd rented in the Isle of Wight one summer. She saw the pale brown pony that stood in a field at the bottom of the garden, eating apples from their hands. She saw Poppy, lying on her back on Ellie's bed, making O's with her tiny red mouth. She saw Hannah, twirling her head around and around, her waist-length ponytail spinning above her head like a propeller. she saw her own funeral. She saw her mother crying. Her father crying. She saw the corpses of her dead hamsters sprinkled on top of her coffin like sods of earth. She saw herself floating above her coffin. She saw herself floating higher and higher. Below her, she saw her room, her sofa bed, the grimy, unwashed bedsheets, the tangled knot of duvet, the plastic cages filled with death, the bin overflowing with empty crisp packets, the blocked toilet bowl, streaked brown with rust and bacteria. She crossed her arms across her chest. She closed her eyes. She let herself float higher and higher until she could feel the clouds against her skin, until she could feel her mother's arms tight around her, her breath against her cheek. Chapter 50. When Poppy was around 2 or 3 years old, I decided to put my house on the market. You were giving me a